Welcome to this 11kbw podcast, an education law update by Paul Greterux. This talk was given at the 11kbw local authority conference on the 4th of October 2017 at the Turing Lecture Theatre in London. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.
Thank you very much, James. Good morning, everybody. Education, these are the topics that we're going to cover. I wondered whether we should do some sort of vote as to who's more interested in some things than others, or whether you could just sort of gesticulate or make noises if you're getting bored with one, or hurry up, I want to hear about something near the end. I don't think that's really going to be practicable, but we have got questions and answers at the end, and you can always come and chat to me over lunch if there's anything that's not covered in the short time that I've got. So no particular order. The first this is the list of cases, by the way. So these are all the cases covered in the talk. So confidentiality, first of all. I think we've got some people from Warwickshire here today. Where are the Warwickshire people? Yes. So they will know all about this and Mr. Matalia and his website for people for where he posts 11 plus questions and guidance and help and so on and so forth. And the judgment in this case contains his response to one of the letters before action written, where he sort of said, well, bring it on because this will all bring me lots of publicity for my website. In the end, I think, I don't know, but I assume it landed him with quite a big cost bill that probably outweighs whatever commercial benefit he's got from his website. But anyway, his website published details about 11 plus tests before all candidates had taken it. Warwickshire, I don't think it's unique, had three dates for the 11 plus, the 7th, 14th and 17th of September. Just out of interest, the number of candidates for those dates, 1,600 odd on the first date, so the bulk, 267 on the second and 67 on the third. So the point being, there was still over 300 people hadn't sat it after the first one. The High Court had granted an injunction to restrain this as a breach of confidence, posting these exam questions. The Court of Appeal judge observed this was not on the face of it surprising, and you might wonder how something like this ended up in the Court of Appeal. Pending cases include an appeal against a finding the Pope is Catholic, and also against some findings about bears and where they go to the toilet. But the one thing that gives you a clue, and what led to this, not a clue, this is what led to it, is that there was no evidence that the candidates were told not to disclose the contents of the tests. And this is what led, I think it was Lord Justice Lewison, to grant permission to go to the Court of Appeal. Just to outline the facts briefly, the Council commissioned the tests from the university, administered them on behalf of the schools. The university retained the copyright, but the Court of Appeal said that the council had a substantial and legitimate interest in the maintenance of their confidentiality. The fact that pupils were not told the test was confidential, or they should not discuss the contents with others, was not fatal. The essential element is the defendant is in possession of information that he knows, or viewed objectively, ought to know is confidential, and they said it should be so obvious as to go without saying that an exam paper is confidential. We then have interesting musings in the Court of Appeal about the duty, the extent of any duty on pupils, and the view being, well, there's obviously no problem with the pupils discussing the test, they've just sat with their parents, which again you might think is a statement of the obvious, the possibility of restraining them from publishing the questions on social media was discussed. So, I mean, there's nothing really, in a sense, it's sort of obviously a victory for common sense in that case. The Court of Appeal, no court was ever going to allow people to go around posting exam questions before other pupils had finished sitting them. It just took a bit longer to get to that result because of the slight oddity that nobody had thought to state the obvious to the candidates, which is that these tests are confidential. There's one other confidentiality case. Is there anyone here? Have we got people from Croydon here as well? Have we not? No, or there's supposed to be. Maybe they couldn't come. This is another case involving a lady who describes herself as an educational advocate and runs a company, and the head teacher resigned, and while she was on garden leave, she accessed her work email and forwarded the confidential information to this educational advocate. The defendants had safeguarding concerns and intended to go to the press, but the court issued an injunction preventing this. I've just added what's said there briefly about, again, stating, I think, the obvious. There's a public interest in seeing the school is properly run, the claimant is properly carrying out its responsibilities, but this may lead those who are entitled to do so, for example, parents at the school, to disclose some information either to the appropriate authorities or more widely. That's a matter for them, but it's not something that could be publicised in the way that they were proposing to do. Right, Ofsted next. The big case of the summer came out in August. We're going to come to Durand in a minute. Before we get to that, Peter Oldham's big case, Peter Oldham QC Chambers, the X case, if everyone remembers this, the case about segregation in an Islamic faith school. They had a long-standing practice of gender segregation. It had gone into special measures and then came out of special measures. Then the chief inspector himself visited in June 2016 and blew his top at what he found. And there was another inspection straight after which said this is all, the segregation can't happen, and put them back in special measures. Now, this first case was the injunction to restrain publication. Up until this point, it was very difficult to get injunctions to restrain Ofsted reports. But in this case, the judge was persuaded by the argument about community tensions. That's the slide there. I'm not going to read it out. We haven't got time. But that was what the court was concerned about and led to the injunction being granted. Whether that leads to a more general change of tack going forward in terms of getting injunctions still really remains to be seen. And then the substantive decision, the High Court found that while segregation is capable of constituting discrimination, less favourable treatment could not be assumed and has got to be proved on the evidence, and the court found that it wasn't. And I think the Court of Appeal's decision is pending on this, by the way. It was heard over the summer, and their decision on whether or not the segregation was discrimination is awaited. What I think is the most interesting point, from my point of view, and practical, the sort of cases that one sees, was this argument, well, you've had segregation, the school said, we've had segregation for years, and nobody's ever said this is a problem, and therefore, effectively, it's irrational for you to suddenly conclude it is. And the court said, well, no, because this is a matter of law. Okay? And so the fact that it wasn't raised earlier by Ofsted doesn't mean that the law can somehow be changed by that. There's no sort of principle of estoppel, as it were. And in fact, they said that, you know, the Ofsted were probably bound to it. If they formed the view that actually this was unlawful, then rightly or wrongly, they couldn't not come to that conclusion simply because of their previous erroneous view. But, and here's the key point, I think, the court said it did mean the school should have been given longer to sort itself out. And I think that's really important because a lot of the cases that I've both been involved in and read about involve these Ofsted inspections where the previous inspection is very good, the school's doing very well, then all of a sudden, without anything apparently changing, there's another inspection, they say your school's terrible and you're in special measures. And the schools turn around and say, hang on a minute, last time you came everything was fine and you haven't identified anything that's changed. I've personally had two cases involving exactly that within the last few months. Of course, this, I think, is the key point, is that, well, OK, if Ofsted have made a mistake, it doesn't mean that they can, that you get off the hook, as it were. But if they're saying, well, we got it wrong previously, and now we're saying there is something wrong, the fact that you thought everything and were told that everything was fine previously means you should be given longer to sort yourself out. And you may or may not be aware that Ofsted is consulting upon changes whereby if a good school is it reinspected, and found they're found to be concerns, is rather than there being a published report, they sort of they don't publish, they just write to parents explaining what they found and give the school a bit of time to sort itself out before getting into this situation of the report's going to go on the website, injunctions and so on and so forth. Because Durand, this is the big case, was exactly the same sort of scenario. An academy trust that the previous inspection said everything was fine, the next inspection comes along and they're told they're terrible. There were two grounds of challenge, the fairness of the complaints procedure and the Wensbury unreasonableness of the conclusion. It was ground one which succeeded. And this is a big deal. They said Ofsted's complaints procedure was found by the High Court to be irrational. Because, I don't know if anyone has had any involvement of Ofsted, what Ofsted say is, we're not going to look into whether any of your complaints about the merits of our judgment are well-founded because we've got our own moderation and quality control systems which deal with all of that. So, you know, we can't possibly get it wrong. so we're just not going to entertain any complaints that we do. And the court said, well, I'm sorry, that won't do. Now, an application for permission to appeal is pending before the Court of Appeal. We'll have to wait and see what happens. In the meantime, I don't quite know what Ofsted's going to do. I might know in a day or two, because I've got a case on at the moment where we've said, look, the High Court said your complaints procedure's unlawful. You've done exactly the same thing in our case as you did in that case, so what are you going to do about it? And we're waiting for the answer. So it's very much sort of watch this space in terms of Ofsted and its complaints procedure. And the judge made some observations about ground two, which, for reasons of time, I'm going to skip over. This is a very interesting case. It's only a first-tier tribunal decision, but, again, I think potentially opens, or whether you call this a can of worms or a can of opportunities, I suppose depends upon your perspective. This was yet another case where Ofsted went from a good inspection to a terrible one in a short period of time. The father of one of the pupils applied under the Freedom of Information Act for information relating to the inspection, all the notes, all the internal emails, everything that went on behind the scenes. Ofsted refused. The Information Commissioner upheld the refusal, but the FTT allowed the appeal. There's two things really to note about this. Is if you look at the decision, I've given you the reference, Ofsted and the DfE didn't really put in any evidence at all about what the prejudice was. They said, well, what's the prejudice that they were relying upon for not disclosing the information? They said four things. Well, it's going to distraction, which the tribunal said presumably, because it wasn't spelled out, presumably of school leaders and staff from the task of improvement. The familiar argument that the DfE would be deprived of the safe space required to make informed judgments on intervention. The diversion of DfE resources from work on interventions to deal with parental factions, and the potential for misrepresentation of Ofsted findings by partisan lobbying groups. I don't think the judge could have been more scathing than he was if you read the decision about this. The short version of it is that's a load of codswallop. He said none of this was made out. The evidence is completely rubbish. And what evidence there is, I don't think, comes close to establishing this. Interestingly also, the judge says, well, there's a public interest. To the extent there is a balancing exercise, the public interest, there is a strong and countervailing public interest, which would outweigh any prejudice of people understanding how it is that a school has gone from being good to so bad in such a short space of time. So, as I say, it's only a first-tier tribunal decision, but one that I think is likely to lead to more requests following adverse inspections for all of the internal documentation. We'll have to see whether Ofsted and or the DfE put in more evidence next time than they did in that particular case. Right, exclusions. This one, there's no reported case, but you might remember it was in the news. St Olive's School in Kent. Anyone here from Kent? Yes, you probably remember this. It was in the mainstream press. It never got any further than a claim being issued, and then it was withdrawn because the school conceded. What happened is, and this was said to be widespread practice, grammar school excluding children halfway through the sixth form at the end of the lower sixth because their marks weren't good enough. Getting rid of them before they drag down their performance tables. Government guidance says, well, you can only exclude for behaviour or disciplinary reasons, so what does the school think it was doing? Well, we don't know formally because they just conceded the claim and let the pupils back in. Andrew Sharland from Chambers had some involvement in that. Whether or not this ever happens again, or whether everybody else who does it has seen this and thought, right, we better change our practices, or whether we're going to get another challenge in future. This one, again, is not a case, but I've mentioned it caught my eye in the news because I've had two cases involving this problem, and it's enormously difficult. I've simply cut and pasted from The Guardian just an extract from the report. I think, like all press reports, I think it's sort of a bit more sensationalist than is the reality. It's a letter before action that was apparently written to the DfE saying, you said you were going to give us some guidance about what to do where a school child alleges rape or sexual assault by another, and the guidance hasn't been issued. And that's essentially the story. This is enormously difficult. As I say, I've had two cases involving this. It's enormously difficult because it all blows up before anyone's got to the bottom of the matter and the truth of it. So pupil A will say, pupil B sexually assaulted me or raped me. Pupil B says, no, I didn't. And they're in the same school or possibly even in the same class. What is the school to do in that situation? Because the police investigation will typically take weeks. The short answer is that there is no easy answer. It is enormously difficult because if you accept that they can't stay together, then somebody has got to have their normal schooling disrupted in some way, shape or form, whether it's being educated elsewhere, whether it's going to a different school. And of course, where you've got a conflict as to what happens, then whoever you pick to be the person who moves, then they're going to say, well, that's completely unfair, because either they'll say, I've been sexually assaulted by this person and I'm the one who's got to leave. And the other person will say, well, hang on a minute, just because this person said I've sexually assaulted them, why do I have to leave? I didn't do anything wrong. And so it'll be interesting to see whether any guidance does come up. And I simply mention it because if you do find yourself dealing with that situation, as I say, it's not in my experience, uncommon at all. And there are no easy answers. I'm afraid. The last one is an actual reported case, but I think the slides really speak for itself. The only point I would add to that is the remedy in this case was reconsideration. And then one other one is a bit of a collector's item, this. This was a case that James Cornwell in Chambers did. A Year 11 student was offered a place in the sixth form. Shortly after accepting the place, he was caught smoking cannabis in the school. Exclusion was the stated sanction for that behaviour, not withdrawal of offer, but the school withdrew the offer rather than exclude so as not to disrupt his GCSE year. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, how much longer before this talk ends? You're thinking, hang on a minute, doesn't the admissions code say you can only withdraw offers if there has been... the parent hasn't accepted in time, well, there's basically fraud. The answer is, and this is why this is a collector's item, X School is a city technology college, which I think last time I looked, there were only about five or six in the entire country. They were sort of the sort of proto-academies back in the day. And whilst maintained schools have to follow the school admissions code and academies by virtue of law, and academies have to by virtue of their funding agreement, CTCs don't. Now, the judge said the school was unique. As I say, I don't think the judge is quite right, because I think there are four or five others. But that was the answer in this case. What the answer would have been otherwise, I mean, it may be the school wouldn't have done it. They'd have just simply pursued the exclusion route rather than the withdrawal of the offer. But I thought that case was worth flagging up for you. Right, education otherwise, if you remember Section 19 of the Education Act... you local authorities have to make arrangements for the provision of suitable education at school or otherwise than at school for those children of compulsory school age who, by reason of illness, exclusion from school or otherwise, may not for any period receive suitable education unless such arrangements are made for them. Now, what happened here was a very, very sad case involving a child with severe learning difficulties, pervasive development disorder and autism, who basically came home on the school transport and was discovered by his parents to have been strapped in and had the whole journey naked from the waist down and in a very distressed state with a towel wrapped around him. The parents, as you might imagine, were pretty upset by this. But what happened is they said, right, well, I'm not sending you to school. We're not going to that school anymore. And you've got to provide education otherwise. And the upshot of it all was, as you can see from the slide, which is the court said, well, hang on a minute, no, this has got to be judged objectively. Yes, something went very badly wrong, and yes, the school could have handled it better and its response to it better, but this was effectively a one-off, and there's no reason to think from an objective point of view that it's not reasonably practicable for this child to go back to the school, which is essentially the test. The judge also observed that whilst he was very sympathetic to the parents' response upon discovering the child, the judge did observe that within 4 hours of the school bus turning up home. The parents were demanding a different school. And he also observed that there had been, I didn't use the word campaign, but their parents had been making quite clear for some time that they wanted their child to go to a different school, an independent special school. Private school is going to be a lot more expensive. And the judge said that I'm left with a clear impression that the events were seen by the parents as providing valuable ammunition in their fight to get their son the school they wanted for him. And so essentially it just reiterates the objective nature of the test. And just because a parent says this school's not suitable anymore, you've got to do something else, it doesn't mean that the local authority has to. Right, school attendance. I think everybody knows about this one. If you don't, then see me after class. Platt. I had a glorious victory in the High Court on behalf of Mr. Platt for parents up and down the country. And then in the Supreme Court, we lost. Clive Sheldon was leading me on that, so it's obviously all his fault. I've done talks about this before, and I always have to check myself, because if I'm not careful, I start ranting about the decision and how, as a piece of judicial reasoning, it's absolutely abysmal, whatever you think about the rights or wrongs of it. But I'm going to try not to do that. Just as a reminder of where we are at least, we have the virtue of simplicity. If your child has a single unauthorised absence from school, that could even be as little as half a day. It could even be as little as a few minutes late on one occasion after the stated time. Then you, the parent, commits the offence under Section 444. That's it. There are 8.5 million days of unauthorised absence every term on average up and down the country. That's a lot of criminal offences. What the Supreme Court said is, well, the answer to that is a sensible prosecution policy, as opposed to all those other areas of law where a sensible prosecution policy is apparently not required. But I'm in danger of doing what I said I wouldn't do. I will just flag up for you two potential points for the future, because as I say, it's dead easy from the strict point of view. There is no legal defence if you, the local authority, prosecute a parent for an authorised absence. Subject only to these two points, I think, in accordance with the rules prescribed by the school, is what the Supreme Court said regularly meant. But what rules? I mean, most schools don't have rules saying you've got to come every day. Does it mean all school rules of any nature? If you break any school, if your child breaks any school rule, probably not. I think it's all about attendance. But they said, the Supreme Court said that's what it means without elaborating further. And like I say, whilst it's obvious that your kid's got to go to school during term time, as I say, in theory at least, because of the way the law's worked out, if you turn up late, then that can be the offence also, and schools do sometimes have different times for what time you have to be there, what time you can be there, what time the bell goes, what time you've got to be in class, what time the registers close, which of those is relevant. Far more relevant, I think, is challenges where the code of conduct is not complied with. So you have to have a code of conduct on this. And it might also be more informal. I mean, I got an email just the other day from my son's school, which had their usual stuff about attendance and how important it is, and said, if your child has more than 15 unauthorised absences, session being half a day, in the current and or previous term, then we'll issue you with a penalty notice, which seems to me to be completely clear. And if they gave me a penalty notice, if we only missed, say, 5 or 10 or anything less than the 15, would I have a challenge? You know, maybe. So I think that's the thing to watch out for, is that you are, as a local authority, following all the guidance that's out there, so there can be no sort of abusive process type arguments. Right, SEM, we're going to have to rampage through the remaining slides. And I think I can do this very quickly, because these are just sort of headline points on SEM. This first case, this was where the parents said, as parents sometimes do, I don't care what school you've named in the plan, I don't care whether I lose my first tier tribunal case and the school gets upheld by the tribunal, my child is not going to that school. And the argument in this case was, well, given that the parents has made that quite clear, then this affects the cost calculation, because her school, the school the parent wanted was £40,000 a year, the school the local authority wanted was £30,000 a year, and the argument was roughly along the lines of, well, £30,000 a year for a placement that's never going to be taken up is an inefficient use of resources, whereas £40,000 for a placement that will be taken up isn't, and therefore they win on the cost calculation. And the upper tribunal said, no, that's the sort of fancy accounting footwork that the Court of Appeal has said should not go on. It also makes the point that Section 1 of the Children Act does not apply in SEN proceedings. This is just a one-liner, but very important. There was lots of consideration as to whether Section 19 of the CFA meant that all of a sudden children were entitled to the best possible, because it refers to having regard to the duty to achieve best possible outcomes. No, it doesn't, is the short answer to that. The duty remains limited to naming what is suitable. This just deals with applications for costs. The main thing to remember about this is if you settle a Sendis case, you want to make sure you put something in saying neither party agrees to apply for costs, because what happened in this case is they settled it and the parent then applied for costs. Reiteration of costs being exceptional, and there's a small point about if there's costs under legal help are to be determined as if there weren't any public funding in place, so the same as for legal aid. This case deals with when a person has moved. I think in view of the time, I'll just say if you've got a case where someone moves from authority A to authority B, whether it's into or out of your authority, this is the case to look at and the slide to look at on that. Transport is an important point. There's been a very recent case just over the summer on this saying notwithstanding what Staffordshire and JM appears to say, it's not the case that transport can never be a special educational provision to meet a special educational need. It's going to be truly exceptional. I've never had a case where it's come close to that in all the years I've been doing it, but the point is that it's a matter of fact to be decided. Then I think we've got negligence very quickly. These are just two county court decisions. They're worth reading. They're on Lawtel simply because of what the courts say about standards in the classroom. There's a lot of sort of interesting insights the way at least two judges think about what is acceptable levels of risk and so on and so forth in both of those cases. But I'm running out of time, so I better skip over those. Striking teachers. This was my joke to keep you all awake at the end. There are some striking teachers, but it's not that sort of striking teacher. This is teachers who go on strike. If you go on strike as a teacher, do you lose 1/365 of your pay, or do you lose 1/260 of your pay, being the working days? And the answer the Supreme Court gave was that it is the former. The deduction is 1/360. So if you are a newly qualified teacher at the bottom of the salary scale, the Supreme Court decision has saved you £25 for every day you go on strike. And if you are at the top of the pay scale, a head teacher in Inner London, you can go on strike and save £129 from what you would have had to been deducted if the decision had gone the other way. Just a reminder of the salary scales for teachers. So there we go. I said it was a bit of a rampage through the ones at the end. As I said at the beginning, if there's anything that I skipped over you wanted to hear more about, you can either squeeze it into the questions before lunch, or you can come and see me over lunch. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. For more details, please visit 11kbw.com.